I am going to read first from the preface to my book, Selected Poems, in Five Sets, of 1970. The poems are by Laura Riding. In the preface, I speak as Laura Jackson of my turning from poetry, but I speak as of one person with the former, identity continuing without break in a continuing unlimited commitment to care for words. The idea care for words may seem not big enough to contain the idea of poetry. If the care is a full care, the idea of poetry must be found not big enough to contain the idea of care for words. In initial brevity, the theme of my later view of poetry, of which I give a rather simple summary in my preface. My history, as one who was for long a devout advocate of poetry and then devoutly renounced allegiance to it as a profession and faith in it as an institution, raises a question of consistency. Those who know my poems, those who have cared for them, those who have not, those who have drawn from their inner attitude and their linguistic qualities propulsive force for attempts to transcend in their own poems mere period modernism, have for the most part, as the indications go, shrugged off my change of view of poetry as exhibiting an inconsistency so bizarre as to be explicable only in private life terms. This notion has seemed justified by my protracted public silence on the subject. By 1962, I had made but a single statement on it in print, and that, coming before I had explored all the significances of the new view, was a cautious generalization. The impression that my break with poetry might not be a critically responsible act was strengthened by the infusion of colorable insinuations into the flowways of literary rumor. When at last I began to speak explicitly on my changed view of poetry, the question of consistency was my first concern, but not in relation to myself as one who had lapsed from it extraordinarily, mysteriously. The story I had to tell was of my becoming so much aware of a discrepancy, deep-reaching, between what I called the creed and the craft of poetry, which I might otherwise describe as its religious and its ritualistic aspects, that I perceived the impossibility of anyone's functioning with consistency in the character of poet. Two exceptions to this impossibility must be made. There is a formal consistency possible in ever-prolonged evasion of the challenge to honor with which poetry confronts its practicing devotees. And there is an organic consistency up to a point, the point in consistent endeavor to meet the challenge, where awareness comes, as come it must in such endeavor, of an ultimate impossibility of meeting it and remaining a poet. I can make here only a meager identification of the challenge poetry holds. What compatibility can there be between the creed offering hope of a way of speaking beyond the ordinary, touching perfection, a complex perfection associable with nothing less complex than truth, and the craft tying the hope to the hope to verbal rituals that court sensuosity as if it were the judge of truth? Straining of effort to achieve compatibility between these will lend moral coherence to the effort and for long employ a native will in a poet to consistency. If poets strain hard enough, they must reach the crisis point at which division between creed and craft reveals itself to be absolute. If, with intuition of final trouble ahead, they slacken the straining to a slow, morally comfortable rate of subsidence, neither they nor their public will feel anything worse to be happening than a tempering of moral intensity to the dignity of advancing maturity. The backing away of poets of better than average conscience from extreme testing of the possibilities of consistency in the poet role passes unnoticed because no poet before me has gone to the very breaking point. There is nothing in the poetic corpus to suggest the pertinence to poetry of a higher standard of scrupulosity than that observed in its historic best. Someone cited Rimbaud to me in this connection, but it was not in the cause of consistency that he abandoned the poet role. I shall speak of him again. I have distinguished a formal consistency as peculiar to certain poetic procedure. In this procedure, there is also a straining of effort, but the challenge to honor is never answered in this straining. All effort is expended in problems of craft. Such straining can be highly intense, and simulate in its intensity straining of the kind aimed at keeping a moral proportion between poetic craft and the sacred poetic motive. And it can seem to be blessed with success because the results appear to be good poems, the actual tinkering being concealed under carefully mixed and applied literary polish. Further, a sanctimony of seriousness about poetry always accompanies craft straining, and functioning as a guarantee of good quality excites predisposition to confidence. Though the procedure does not rise above poetic journalism, the steady-handedness with which it is conducted has the noble appearance of moral care. The difference between such industry and the moral strenuosities of those who try to make one sense of the two senses of poetry has never been distinctly appreciated, and has become obscured in the thickening opacity of the problem of poetry as a problem in the field of language of extensive human importance. The work of poets taken in period mass is very difficult to order qualitatively for any one period without arbitrary critical differentiations. It probably presents more confusion, characteristically, than a period mass of the work of other literary professionals, or of the professionals of other areas of culture activity. Poetic performance being of its outspeaking nature more personalized and more subject thus to individual variation. I venture the judgment, at any rate, as one able to contemplate the immediate poetic scene against the background of antecedent poetic vistas with the objectivity of a non-competitor and a critic having only general human extramural affiliations, that never before has there been so great a variety of individual poet styles and so much poverty of thematic content of the kind the word poetry, in the entire virtue of its meaning, signifies. Religious, to use the word again, in magnitude of scope and purity of interest value. The total display crackles with craft individualism, but there is no sparkling, no brilliance. All is suffused with a light of drab poetic secularity. Having shown some general aspects of the question of consistency, I take up again the tale of myself. The last poems I wrote are contained in my Collected Poems, published in 1938. I can be seen in that book to be striving to find at once the poetic extreme and in it the mark of human fullness of utterance, and to be heading towards finalities of proof of poetry and of the poet role itself. There is also to be seen there a movement of developing sensibility above the personal or professional, reflecting consciousness at large of the approach of human life in the whole to a term, and of there being to come something after. The relation of the sense of a something after to the striving is precisely that of religious sensibility giving itself into the keeping of poetic sensibility, which has a partial identity with it, but is also otherwise engaged. Poetry invites vision of a lasting, living fact awaiting our arrival at a state of grace in which we know it, speak it. It is also the patron of a historic love of the patterning of words with a physically ordered nicety, pleasing to human pride. I forced the issue in my poems of the spiritual serviceability of what has been regarded in all past human ages, and automatically continues so to be in this, as the universal type of the spiritual best in language. In my preface to the collected edition of my poems, written with my commitment to poetry more ardent than ever, I spoke of poetry as being the actual process of realizing the good existence, described itself as poetry positive, all of truth. There was an ultimate, a perfect truth to reach, and poetry was the way. Certainly no other language path had yet opened before this most comprehensive aspiration. When I had sealed the book with the preface, I later knew, sealed my labors of poet. I felt at least then that the going on would be different, would have a new decisiveness. I told my friends at the time that I foresaw a pause in poems making of perhaps as much as 4 years. In less time than that, I saw that I had reached poetry's limit. The taint of complacence stands out sharply in the backward look at poetry. Generally, in the composition of human customs, there is a self-complacence that obliges aspiration to yield immediate satisfactions to pride. The craft requisites of poetry accommodate the urgency in it. I think of a terrible early poem of mine, The Mask, in which I stumbled into a clear vision of this actuality, though not a clear understanding of it. I include it in my selections with this prefatorial gloss. The taint referred to in the poem is eternal, only if poetry is eternal. But the course to the margin where this is knowable is hard and comfortable. I know of no one besides myself and my husband Schuyler, who a poet, but beyond that a scholar of poetry, familiar as a brother with the yearning man-soul in it, who has put feet across the margin on the further ground, the margin being the knowledge that truth begins where poetry ends, or, as I said in introducing a BBC reading of my poems, that for the practice of the style of truth to become a thing of the present, poetry must become a thing of the past. I have initiated enough poets into the idea of linguistic discipline for truth's sake in earlier time to know how verbally insensitive to considerations of truth poets can be, though behaving as persons born privy to it. In recent time, a few poets have professed agreement with my later view of poetry and returned to their desks believing they could beat the impossibility that they had acknowledged. A word now as to Rimbaud's quitting poetry and mine. In the poetic adventure, I had a structure of hope for shelter, whatever happened, and my inspiration came from everywhere. He was inspired by desperation. He flung it out. It narrowed back fast upon him and would have destroyed him eventually had he not run away from it. For me, the essence of the adventure was in the words. He used them as stuff from which to distill an elixir giving power to make happiness out of unhappiness. In a book on language by my husband and myself, long in the making, still a third short of completion when he died, July 4th, 1968, we speak of poetry and make reference to my poetic work. Her objective in poetry may be said to have gone beyond the poetic as a literary category and reached into the field of the general human ideal in speaking. She tried to find in poetry the key to a way of speaking that would realize this spiritual ideal, looking to an eventual solution in poetry of the universal problem of how to make words fulfill the human being and the human being fulfill words. Readers will, I hope, better understand my poems and the sequel to them as well, for my stressing here the conflict in poetry between the motive of humanly perfect word use and that of artistically perfect word use, though I know how difficult it is for people to see the latter, which seems so much an innocent contributor of loveliness, as a parasitic partner in the poetic enterprise, taking an unholy share, ever over large in its management and the honors. And just what is the sequel to my poems? I have written that which I believe breaks the spell of poetry, but I must be in no hurry as to that. I rest here at saying that this preface is itself part of the sequel. I do not agree to the presentation of my poems unless, and for long there was no unless, I have leave to tell why there are no more, or an equivalent commentary is made on my behalf. With my poems and the commentary, I point to the predicament in which poetry locks tongue, ear, the organs of feeling and intelligence, and even the sum of being, the soul. My poems are good illustrations of poetry, and as such may be considered to be also part of the sequel. There will be reading of the poems in this book without reference to the preface, and with my consciousness of this goes an inconsistency in cooperating in making them available, since it is not my interest merely to add to the quantity of easily available poetic reading matter. I judge my poems to be things of the first water as poetry, but that does not make them better than poetry, and I think poetry obstructs general attainment to something better in our linguistic way of life than we have. I can only hope that the poems themselves will soften this inconsistency by making the nature of poetry to which they are faithful plainer in its forced, fine suspension of truth. Poetry and truth have both been so much hashed that there is little whole perception of what they are.